This morning, the sermon really is me telling you a story that I found when I went looking for hope. And it starts in rural Pennsylvania with a young woman who was, well, her parents were from India, but she was born in America, so she was American, except that all of her classmates in rural Pennsylvania did not think she was American. They thought she was from India. And she was one of the few people of color in India, and so in India, in America. And so she was teased and given a pretty hard time in her small school in a pretty small town. And so as she grew up, she was unhappy and she felt like the world just wasn't right. And she thought for many years that it was because she was a person of color in small town America. And then when she was about 14, she realized that there was something else happening. 14, about the time she started to dye her hair blue and also to cut herself because she was in a lot of pain. And that's when she realized that what was happening at home was actually where the pain was. That what her father had been doing to her since, well, for as long as she could remember, was really what was causing her heartbreak. That his abuse of her physically for many years was what was really tearing her apart, and that school was almost superficial compared to that. So she began to sort that out, and then her father died when she was 16. And I suppose on the one hand that was some relief. She was no longer abused by him, but then he was dead, and that had a whole other set of challenges in their lives. But she's 16, just beginning to sort herself out, and she's figured at least one thing out, which is how to do really well in school. And she heads off to Harvard at the end of high school. So it seems like she's living the American immigrant dream, right? She's pulled herself together and is heading out for a bright future. Except that, as you have probably already guessed with her history, she struggles all the time. She's angry all the time. She gets migraine headaches several times a week because she's so angry. Her stomach just hurts all the time, and she can barely digest food because she's so angry, and she doesn't know what to do with it. And she has figured out one thing, though, that she's going to go to law school, and she's going to be a prosecutor, and she's going to put people who abuse children behind bars. So she's going along, struggling, and probably outwardly succeeding wonderfully. And then her boyfriend at the time gets a grant to go back to India and start a school in Mumbai for children who are the children of sex workers. And she decides to go with him. She has time before law school starts, and she could have this experience, and she has something to offer these children. So she goes, and she gets there, and she discovers that all of this anger that she's been carrying around with her physically for so long, when it meets the trauma of these children and these women, she can't stand it. She can't help them because she's so overwhelmed herself. So she leaves this project that her boyfriend is working on and backpacks around India for a little while and ends up in Dharamsala, which you may know is where the Dalai Lama is living and where the exiled Tibetan community lives. Now, a lot of people end up there. Have any of you ever ended up there? Yes. So raise your hands again, because people might want to talk to you at coffee hour about what that place is like. So it's a community of people who have been tremendously traumatized. They were brutalized by the Chinese government before they escaped over the border. They are also a community of people who live in meditation and live with ways of dealing with trauma and what we carry physically from that afterwards. So she arrived there and she started to talk to them not about meditation but about trauma and how you live with that. And they talked to her about what had happened to them, and they described horrifying stories of violence done to them, violence done to their children, violence that they had been forced to commit. by the Chinese government. And they would be angry and they would weep, and then they would stop the story and they would begin to laugh again, and they would put their arms around each other and they would eat together and seem to go on with their lives, which amazed her. And so she said, how do you do that? How do you be angry but then get over it? And they said, well, we practice forgiveness. And I think after she asked this several times, someone said to her, so why are you so angry? What's going on with you? Which is an interesting conversation to open in an exile community like that. So she told some people. And she was a little bit embarrassed to tell them because of what they had told her about their lives. And they said, oh, what happened to you is terrible. That's really horrible. Which I think was a moment of enlightenment for her. That what had happened to her was real and terrible and had had clearly an impact on who she was. And then they said, well, you should practice forgiveness. And she said, what? And they said, yes, yes, you know, you should go and talk to the Dalai Lama about it. You should write him a letter. And he'll suggest some things to you, because forgiveness in a, you know, inside of a family, you should talk to the Dalai Lama about it, which is a phrase that most of us will never hear in our lives. Did you have the good fortune of hearing that when you were, did you get to talk to him, His Holiness, when you were there? No. Alas, but you can still tell us what it's like to be there. Well, she was a little taken aback by that, but she did finally write a letter to His Holiness the Dalai Lama, and I want to get the exact words of what she said in her letter. But she wrote this letter, and she walked up to the monastery where he lived, and she dropped it off. And they said, "We'll come back in a week for a response." And this is what she said to him. She said, "Anger is killing me, but it motivates my work. How do you work on behalf of abused and oppressed people without anger as a motivating force?" Well, she went back a week later, and the person who had taken her letter said, "Oh, yes, come in," and took her through the monastery to the personal secretary of the Dalai Lama, who said, "Can you come back on Tuesday? He'll be in town then, and he has an hour for you." I mean, you say yes, of course, but that seems like a big hour to wait until Tuesday for. But she went back on Tuesday, and she again was taken through the monastery and into the room with the Dalai Lama, and she sat down with him, and she managed to speak, which I think I might not be able to do. And she described her work with abused women, and she described what she wanted to do as a prosecutor, and she described how angry she was that these things kept happening to children and to women in the world. And he listened, and he listened. And he was remembering her question about how do you do this work without anger being the motivator. And then he talked about what had happened in his own life, his own anger, his own history of being traumatized. And then he talked about his meditation practice, and he talked about how to forgive. And then he said to her, "Do you think that you have been angry long enough?" And she had to think about that. She had to think about what her father had done to her. She had to think about all of the women and children who she had met in the world. And she had to think about her own body and how she was doing. And she answered, "Yes, I have been. I'm ready to be the way you are," the Dalai Lama, and the people who she had met in his community. She was ready to be able to put it down. He said, good, there are two things for you to do. The first is to meditate every day. And she said, okay, I can do that. I can go and take a meditation class and I can learn to sit and I can do that. He said, good. And then he said, and you must open your heart to your enemy. You must find a way to align yourself, in this case with your father, but with anyone who with whom you're angry. And she said, no, I can't do it. I can't do that. And he laughed because he's like that, and he can, like some of you have, and he can do that. So he patted her on the knee, and he said, oh, it's all right. Just meditate. So she did. She went and took one of these 10-day meditation workshop. Have any of you done one of these extended meditation workshops where you sit for 100 hours or more? No, you're not that one. Well, they're available all over the place. You can go to Western Massachusetts and do this if you feel like you're ready to be on the path. And that's what she did. 10 days of meditation for 10 hours a day in silence the whole time. And at the very end of those 10 days, she had this moment when she realized that the anger was gone. She had spent some days just sitting, and then she had spent some days noticing where in her physical being she held that anger. And she noticed that she re-experienced her abuse sitting on a meditation cushion. And it helped her understand how it was still in her mind, even though it was over. And so at the end of the 10 days, she had this moment when she could, in fact, open her heart to her enemy and then walk out into the world a different person. And she says it's gone forever as long as she meditates. She hasn't tested it yet, but she's suspicious that if she stopped meditating consistently, that the anger would re-inhabit her body and her mind. So she did all this, and then she went to law school, which was the plan. It's always how it goes, isn't it? You have the plan, and then you have what happens. So she arrived at law school to become a prosecutor, and that's not what she wanted to do anymore. She knew that that just wasn't what she wanted to do anymore. So partway into the first term, she told her professor, you know, I think I should drop out. And she doesn't say this in her story, but I think the professor probably noticed a great mind at work and thought, not letting you go. He said, no, don't drop out. Just change how you do law. Why don't you defend women who have been abused, and you can be a defense attorney and work on it from the other side. She said, of course, she found out that you don't get to choose whether to do that. And as she went into law practice, she found out that she had to be a defender sometimes for people who had done things in the world that were the very same things that had been done to her. But she learned how to do that, how to keep her own peace and be with the humanity of whoever she was defending. And then she learned about this thing. Apparently a friend had been talking to her about it for years, and it suddenly clicked. You've probably had that experience too. You have this sudden revelation, oh, this is such a great thing. I've just discovered it. And someone in your life says, oh yeah, that's the thing I've been talking to you about for years. Well, this happened to her. The phrase restorative justice. You may have heard about this being practiced. Certainly you've heard about it being practiced in South Africa with the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Restorative justice is when, instead of focusing on the punishment of the perpetrator of a crime, you focus on how do we restore the world that has been broken. And often that means getting the victim and the perpetrator of a crime to sit together with lots of other people in the room and teaching the victim to tell the story of what happened to them, how they experienced whatever the crime was, how it affected their life, what was taken from them and what was broken. Sometimes that's material, but as you know, even in the simplest burglary, there's a lot more that's taken than just the bicycle, to put it on the smallest scale. And she has practiced restorative justice in cases where people have been killed. And she gets the family of the victims in the room and the person who committed the crime in the room. And they talk about what's been lost. And then they talk about why this happened in the first place, which always is a much more complicated story than what we hear in the news, and much more complicated than can ever come out in a regular criminal trial. And then they talk about what would have to happen in the world to restore the world, to bring the world together again. And of course, there's some things that can't be done. But there's much more that can be done in this way of talking about things than in just sending someone off to prison, where there's likely no fresh understanding about life and certainly no potential for the victims to reach some level of healing and recovery. So this is what she does in the world now. She's figured out how to use her law background and to use her centering as a human being to create wholeness where typically our culture can't figure out how to create that wholeness. It started, of course, by having her own world torn apart and then traveling a long way, both physically and emotionally, to learn how to put it back together. So, as I've said, this is, of course, how things were done with to the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa. I think this is what Joanna Macy does in her work for the Earth. She tries to get us to see what harm has been done, what losses there are, to tell the whole of the story. And just to tell the story, not even necessarily to try to assign full blame, just tell the story of what's been lost. And then tell the story of why it happened. Just tell the whole story. And then begin to create something new and whole. And I think that's what we're about with this 50th anniversary of the March in Selma. I think it's about learning to forgive. I heard a piece on the radio, of course, about the Whitney Plantation. Did any of you hear this piece on the radio? It's this museum that they've started, well, a man has started in Louisiana, that's a slavery museum. And when I came in the middle of the story and he said slavery museum, and I thought, well, yes, whoa. And then he said, what I want is for us to be able to tell the story. We don't talk about it. We try to just pretend, and I think someone talked about this last week, that they're trying to take it out of the textbooks. Well, that didn't happen. We didn't, slaves? Not us. And he said, I want this plantation to exist so that we will talk about this, so that we'll tell the story. And then we can begin to bring wholeness back. We can begin to create something fresh when we tell the story. These are the questions in this woman's story, Sujatha Baliga. These are the questions from her life that I will carry in all of the work that I do, my own work and working with others. Anger is killing me, but it motivates my work. How do you work on behalf of, and you can fill in that blank with anything, but she says, how do you work on behalf of abused and oppressed people without anger as a motivating force? Do you feel you have been angry long enough? Open your heart to your enemy. Just meditate.